Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Android Central Podcast. It is Friday, September 20th, also known as Nintendo Switch Lite Day. See what I did there? But unfortunately, we're actually going to talk a little bit about the iPhone today, so hold on to your butts. To join me in our adventures into enemy territory, Jerry Hildenbrand, welcome back to the show.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm great. Really happy it's Friday, actually. It's one of the first Fridays I've been like, oh my God, I'm so ready for the weekend. And also ready for the weekend, I assume, Andrew Martinick, how are you doing?
I am very ready for the weekend, but it is still very much the morning and I have the entire day ahead of me. Unlike you, you're pushing up against noon over there, guys. And, you know, that's just not very fair.
I also appreciate the fact that you get up early to pod with us because, you know, it's hard. It's hard getting your thoughts together at like 8, 9 in the morning. So I appreciate
it. I totally wouldn't.
No
do
kidding.
It. I ain't gonna lie.
I appreciate it. So today we're, you know, it's iPhone 11 launch day. Everybody's going crazy on the Twitter. So we got to talk about it a little bit.
My goodness.
All the reviews came out this week and they kind of make it seem like the camera is a big deal. So we'll talk about that a little. We're also going to talk about the Huawei Mate 30. I'm just going to say it. It's a show, folks. There's
different,
no other way
deal.
To couch it. You can't avoid it. It's bad what's happened over there. And then at the end of the show, we'll kind of make fun of the Galaxy Fold because holy cow, it deserves it. We'll get into why in a little bit. So, Andrew, our colleague Hayato is down in New York. He's been there for the last couple of days shooting some camera comparison footage with Michael Fisher, mm-hmm. Mr. Mobile, and Rene Ritchie of iMore and Vector. And this is after Rene reviewed the iPhone 11, the iPhone 11 Pro, and he announced that the best camera you can buy. He said that it's the new Night King. Now, Rene, he likes Apple. He likes the iPhone. But, you know, he's not the only one who's said that it beats the Pixel, not just in night mode, but also just overall in terms of clarity, speed, and all the other metrics that we like to praise the Pixel for. Well, not the speed so much, but
no.
Let's go into it. So, three cameras on the iPhone 11 Pro, with including an ultra wide, new night mode. What's been your take from reading all the hot takes of the iPhone 11 reviews?
Well, I think that the speed point actually is a very important one because it's clear what Apple's capable of doing with its custom processor is handle switching between cameras and taking really consistently good photos with all three cameras. That's a pretty big deal. The speed is something that we get from other phones like Samsung phones switching between cameras, but they don't all do continuous switching during video very well. And they also don't do creating a photo with similar color profiles and clarity and quality between all three cameras very well. And that's something that's really stood out to me looking at the iPhone 11 Pro coverage is it doesn't really matter. You just kind of pick your focal length and you decide what you want to do with it. And there isn't a dramatic drop off or any, you know, big change except at night, you know, because different apertures and just general, you know, issues with changing lenses there.
Okay, Jerry, the iPhone XS cameras were, you know, pretty, it was obvious even to Apple fans that they were kind of underwhelming. With this one, there's new sensors, 312 megapixel sensors throughout, assuming the same actual sensors throughout. We have different apertures and focal lengths for all three, but this year they're doing something called semantic rendering, which is a fancy way of saying that they kind of pick apart a shot and they identify parts of the shot that need to be rendered and exposed in different ways. So like they know how to render a face differently from the sky behind it, from the trees, right behind the subject. They know what to blur and what not to blur. Take us through what exactly is happening when Apple does this kind of, you know, processing and how different it is from, say, somebody like Google doing the same thing.
Well, this is something that apps have tried to do. I forget the name of the popular ones, but Perfectly Clear was one for Android. I believe it was out for the iPhone as well. It can look at your picture and try to adjust faces or background. And software was kind of good at it. Some of the pictures look better. But Apple is actually doing that with the image processing with the raw data, which is going to make a huge difference there. They can detect all the edges of all the things and use a little bit of logic and based, you know, on the shape and the distance. This is a person. This is what we want to do to make that person look sharp in focus and, you know, make their face a little beautified. Those are all things that can be done through the image processor. And like I said, that's so much better than trying to do it in software. What Google does is a little bit different because they try to use machine learning, you know, instead of just simple logic. And sometimes it works better. Other times, especially when they first started things like sunglasses or a hairstyle that had, you know, stuck out far from the head, those kind of things were just a mess. And they still can be because Apple or Google is depending on, you know, machine learning where you've taught a machine this is what a person should look like. Not everybody looks the same. Apple has the right way to do it for their ecosystem. And Google has the right way to do it for Google's ecosystem. They're going to be different.
So maybe it's hard to say because we haven't seen the Pixel 4, but what's better or worse maybe about the way that Google traditionally processes photos, right? Like you see a photo by a Pixel and you're like, yep, that's from Google. Like, you know, that's
right.
It has that particular, style, that particular, you know, exposure, dynamic range combination. It just looks like a Pixel photo.
And part of what we're seeing and maybe not realizing it is Google is, like I said, they use machine learning that they know what a thing is going to look like. Let's say a truck. They know what a truck should look like. And if it looks really bad in your photo, Google can fix that. Apple's not going to be able to fix something that's completely ruined because you messed the shot up. Google can try. Sometimes they're successful, but even when they're successful, if you pixel peep, if you blow it up and look, it looks artificial and a little out of place. That's our eyes see that, and that's why most everybody who is a smartphone enthusiast can tell a Pixel photo from any other phone because they all have this look about them. In general, I think it looks good. And there's a lot of room left for Google to refine that. And I'm sure every day somebody is working on making it just a tiny bit better. And that all adds up. I like it. I'm into, you know, machine learning. Let's let machines do everything. If they can tell me, you know, recognize a speed limit sign in a self-driving car, well, they can make my cat look like it's sitting still.
Right. And I mean, that brings us into night sight, night mode. You know, Apple didn't have a night mode until this year. And it seems like Apple's doing it a little differently from Google in the sense that they're not necessarily brightening up the whole scene. They're just kind of brightening parts of it to make it a little bit more visible, but they're not going overboard. They're not adding a huge amount of HDR and making it look a little fake. And you know, Google does a really good job with Night Sight, and they have with the Pixel 3, and they likely will do a lot better with the Pixel 4. But, you know, it's clear that when you do a Night Sight shot, it's not always exactly what the scene looks like. It's often very exaggerated. Andrew, what's your take on the way that Apple's approaching this? Because, you know, it seems a little bit more naturalized. Maybe it's not quite as bright as it is on Night Sight, but people are saying that it may look a little bit better because it's more realistic.
I think that you nailed it. The photos that you get out of Night Sight on the Pixel they're extraordinary from like an artistic perspective, and they bring out things that just weren't there. You know, Google loves that advertisement where it's basically like a black scene and then it shows it taken with the Pixel and like there's a person there or, you know, whatever. I appreciate that Apple is taking the more natural approach because it's a little more realistic of what you can actually expect a camera that's the size of, you know, what fits in a phone to do. They're just bringing up some of the brightness, bringing up the color that's already there. And from all the examples that I've seen, they're not leaving behind a ton of detail. In a lot of cases, if you look at a lot of the backgrounds and a lot of the, you know, the kind of less consequential stuff in a night sight photo on a Pixel, it's kind of left behind. You have a lot of the back stuff just kind of gets smoothed out and just kind of like chroma noised out, and you lose that. A lot of the iPhone 11 Pro samples I've seen, they leave a lot of that in as if it were a daylight photo. You don't get that kind of just overall smoothed look, or, you know, like you just slid the noise reduction slider in Lightroom all the way to the maximum. You sometimes get that in a lot of night modes, and Apple's not doing that. Now, on the downside against Apple, it doesn't seem like it maybe handles those super, super dark scenes as well, because it's just not pulling, you know, it's not trying as hard as Google is to pull out light just kind of from anywhere it can get it.
You know, it looks to me, Apple is, there's still contrast there. A Pixel night sight shot is pretty washed out. Not to say that it looks bad. Sometimes it's amazing. But if you look at one, especially some of the Pro samples I've seen, there's still contrast between dark and light, and that makes a big difference.
So I just wanted to, you know, it's an important thing to say. When people compare the Pixel 3 to the iPhone 11 Pro, there's 11 or 12 months of improvement between them. We've seen evidence, and it's not conclusive yet, but we've seen evidence, Jerry, that the Pixel 4 will use literally the same sensor as the Pixel 3, which was practically the same sensor as was in the Pixel 2. Year-over-year improvements don't only come from sensor upgrades, because obviously the Pixel 4 will have a Snapdragon 855, which has an improved ISP and DSP. Google itself is going to improve its own machine learning algorithms to make HDR Plus better. The phone will hopefully be considerably faster, and given the more, you know, increased amount of RAM to 6 gigs, the camera app won't derp as much, hopefully. So lots of things to look forward to. But just going to the sensor itself, is it a problem that Google is not making hardware upgrades year over year?
Probably not. You know, we haven't seen it yet, but the way Google is doing things, it makes sense to use the exact same hardware for as long as you can. That means you don't have to adjust all the algorithms you're using.
Exactly.
So if Google can get enough image data from that sensor, and now there's extra sensors, if they can grab the data they need, then they should keep using the same sensor. That's going to throw a wrench in the works when they have to change it.
That's a really interesting way of looking at it. You're basically saying that all of the data that Google has collected to train those machine learning algorithms over the last 3 years has been done with this one sensor, or a variant of this one sensor. And even though the sensor itself was released in 2016, we're talking about the IMX363, that's okay, because it's good enough that if you keep feeding better data into it, it's going to turn out better results.
Right. It's always smart to remember that a Pixel phone, especially, that's a software camera, not a hardware camera. The lens is just there to grab data that Google manipulates completely to build a photo out of.
Yeah, I don't think that it's as much of a problem as, you know, we've liked to harp on Samsung about having the same basic camera for 3 or 4 years now. You know, it's a little easier to give Google a pass when it's creating amazing photos out of that sensor. And you can tell really that the sensor is not the problem with any of the, you know, the issues that you can have with, you know, Pixel photos sometimes being a little washed out in daylight, or, you know, at, you know, for night sight shots being, you know, overly brightened and overly sharpened. Like, that's all tweaks that you're making in the processing side. That's, you know, those things aren't limited, or those problems aren't created by the sensor. The bigger thing this year is going to be, you know, what do they do with that software? And then what do they do with the extra data that, you know, Jerry points out that you're getting from these other two cameras that you have next to it as well.
Okay, so that's actually a good point, because we have a secondary sensor in the Pixel for the first time ever. We know that, again, we're not sure, but we know that it's going to be a telephoto lens, 2x focal length, and it will hopefully give better portrait results, even though Google did an amazing job just with that one camera for 2 years. But, you know, I wonder if the iPhone 11 Pro, just going back there for a second, has had such a massive leap year over year due to all of these things, right? Feeding better information to its neural processor, giving a better, bigger sensor with, I think it's a wider aperture, or maybe not, it's an f1.8. So no, it's not a wider aperture, but the telephoto has a wider aperture this year. Adding that third camera with the, an ultra wide. I just wonder if Google is not handicapping itself for not necessarily the Pixel 4, but a year from now or 2 years from now. If they're not making those upgrades today to start training a new sensor in 2019, will it potentially be to its disadvantage in 2021? Maybe that's being a little bit too abstract, but I think it's important that if all of this data is feeding this one sensor from 2016, why don't they just try to do a better job in 2019 to put themselves in a better position in 2021?
Well, I'm going to go on record with a guess that they've probably got 15 different sensors they're working on right now. What they have works well enough for them, and there's no rush to change it. When they have to change it, hopefully they'll have something that works as good or better.
The other question then is, what is to prevent those improvements from trickling down to the Pixel 3 and the Pixel 2? Why would the Pixel 4 be considerably better if they're just training the same algorithms with the same sensors?
Because the processor and something else that we don't know just yet makes on-device machine learning and running those algorithms so much faster. Look, we're going to be able to run Assistant without an internet connection now. You're not going to be able to do that on your Pixel 3. I'm sorry.
So what else about the iPhone is interesting? I mean, there's, you know, we talked about the ultra wideband a little bit last week, but we didn't have you on the show, Jerry. So this is a new chip inside the iPhone that allows for very precise measurements within indoor areas that don't have access to GPS.
Right.
What is the, you know, right now Apple's just saying that you're going to point at another U1 enabled device and you'll be able to share things over AirDrop, you know, much faster, and that person will float to the top of the list. That sounds nice, I guess, but I'm not an 11th grade student, so I don't I don't need that. What else could this offer in a year or two?
It can act as a time of flight sensor, and that's a big deal. Samsung first brought one to the Android world with their camera. Was that last year? I think it was the 10.
Yes, it was this. Well, I think the first TOF sensor was on the S10 5G.
Yeah. There you go. Now I remember. And that's that can help the camera immensely, as we saw with Samsung. But a time of flight sensor gives you a very precise location and a very precise awareness of everything else that's around you that has the same sensor running on the same band. That we already saw, an improved AirDrop is, just because of this sensor that they're using, this ultra wideband sensing device. But there's so much more you could do with it. You could get rid of Bluetooth beacons completely and just use UWB sensors to do the same exact thing, because they can all be aware of each other. And that's, once you have hardware that can give you that, you get creative minds that find things to do with it. AR, this is going to be huge in AR, and Apple loves AR.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, AR is nice, but it has not been the boon to the App Store to
but Apple
developers to anything, even Apple. You know, I went to an AR session where they were showing off apps built specifically for the iPhone. This was a couple of years ago, and you know, it was certainly impressive, but all the developers that were touting this were like, hey, listen, we built an app and it had nothing to do with AR. And then Apple reached out to us and said, hey, could you put AR in this? Like, could you just, you know, you're making a puzzle game that uses a chessboard or something, or a game board. Just make an AR version of that.
But so, I meant internally, Apple loves it. AR could be, you could put it in Maps. You could put it into iMessage. And I don't mean just, you know, animated emojis. I mean AR if you know, maybe hold your camera button open and you can see other people that have an iPhone that are around you right on your screen. These things are all possible. I don't know. I'm not that creative guy. I don't know what can be done with it, but I know that the precise awareness of this chip really opens the door for a lot of cool stuff.
So I know a really good use for AR, and the only company that's done it is Google. It's the first person maps perspective.
Yes.
That Google launched earlier this year.
Oh man. Here's the problem with that. Okay. Just before you make it sound like it's all amazing, AR in maps, it does not help people pay attention while they're trying to follow maps, walking directions on a sidewalk. In my experience, between all of the people that have run into me and all the people I've watched try to use this feature, it is way worse than the old school looking down at your phone, because now the phone is in the way even when you think you're looking.
But right, I mean, that's them.
People
that's
just
them using
run
it wrong
into on the sidewalk. Well, I mean, you know, people are people, but
what AR can be cool for, though, for personal navigation, that's what I call when you're moving with the phone in your hand. I can't go up and down stairs. I'm in a wheelchair. AR can put and I've seen a demo of this. AR can put a green arrow on the floor to direct me to the elevator and then direct me to the restroom with a handicap stall.
Right. I mean, there are a lot of very practical uses for it. But in terms of commercializing the technology, if the most famous company in the world with the most lucrative app store in the world can't monetize AR yet, we have a problem.
But I think they're doing it for some internal means. I think they're doing this for their own first party stuff. And, you know, of course they want to let developers in on it if they want to. And yeah, more AR apps in the app store would really look good. And Apple would certainly tout that at their next, you know, big conference. But internally, they want to use this chip, and maybe AR is the wrong word for it, because maybe it's not even going to be something you can see. Imagine how much better a thing could be if your phone knew exactly where it was, when it was, where it was 15 seconds ago, and then can predict where it might be 15 seconds from now.
Yeah, yeah, I think the question is what, you know, this would be a slice of creating a new experience or a new feature somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, the feature is not your phone knows exactly how far away it is from something else. Like, that's cool. That's a ruler app or your tape measure app. It's what else is combined with something like that to, you know, create an actual experience somebody cares about.
Andrew, this would be a perfect golfing scope.
Hey, yeah, there you go.
Okay, so ultra wideband, not a huge benefit right now. Down the road, you know, a time of flight sensor is certainly going to make a difference. I just think the idea of having more precise placement of you and your, because basically your phone's always on you. So if your phone can be more precisely placed, you can be more precisely placed. The privacy implications there are significant.
Right.
And if you walk around a mall today, you know how many Bluetooth beacons are pinging your phone anyway. Bluetooth beacons are, precise-ish, but they're not, you know, they're not fantastic.
Bit of a scourge, really.
This is way, way, way more precise than that.
Right. Right.
So down the road, I mean, we know Apple has a serious emphasis on privacy. Google, if they ever put this in a Pixel, I mean, I'm not saying that they're going to avoid the privacy conversation altogether, but what does a company like Google, which makes its money from ads, how can they benefit from a technology like this?
Oh God, you build a Chromecast device into a LCD, and when you get close to it, it advertises things that you want to buy based on your Google profile. That's a simple idea right there, and I can see Google pulling that off without much sweat at all. It's, will we accept something like that?
And I think that all it would do is just, it would enhance all the things that they're already doing, which is, you know, they're using rough location information, you know, just based on the cell tower triangulation and light GPS usage to be able to tell when you're at specific stores. They could then do that indoors now, and they can start to aggregate that data with the purchase data that they're aware of that they buy from credit card companies. And then, you know, this just enhances the things that they're already doing at a minimum.
A more immediate thing they could do would be their indoor mapping. They could make it much better if you would agree to let your phone upload the data that it discovers as you're moving around. Within a week, every indoor location in America would be mapped 100%.
And the carriers would love that if they got access to it too. But
they could sell that to bounty hunters all day.
They promised, Jerry. They promised they would stop doing that.
They promised swore. My bill wouldn't go up too. AT&T, you lied.
Verizon swore on its mother's life.
Of course, and this is why Jerry's still in a compound in the woods.
Yep, with a
chain
on the gate.
Jerry has no address.
There is no Verizon service there for a reason.
Yeah, you're on C Spire. That's the only one that you get.
Be quiet.
Sick burn.
Andrew, we should talk about the Google Fi Unlimited plan. I just remembered that.
Okay, let's talk about it really quick because I don't think it's that good.
Nope, it's not.
And David Ruddick, our friend, wrote a really good piece on this Android Police. Talk about why it's not a great deal for people.
So, man, I really appreciated what Google Fi was doing, then Project Fi at the time, because it was kind of getting people to think in a different way about their phone plan after we had made this full-on transition to like everything's quote-unquote unlimited, but not really unlimited. And with its announcement yesterday, I think it's yesterday, 2 days this week, that they are going to be doing, or not going to. This is the cool thing about Fi, is they just announce something and then it's available. There's an unlimited plan, and it's just exactly a dead copy of every other unlimited plan, where you just pay $80 a month. I think it's 80. 70?
70 or something like
that. It changes depending on how many people you have on your plan, too. So I think it starts at 70 and goes down per person as you add up to 6. And it just gives you, quote-unquote, unlimited data. They change video streams down to 480p. Heard that before. And after 22 gigabytes of data, of your unlimited data, your speeds get throttled down. So it's basically just a straight copy of what T-Mobile did 4 years ago and has since popularized across the entire industry. And
2 years ago, Andrew.
Well, they've been doing a million different things. They've been doing unlimited.
No. This is important because 4 years ago, they were still doing that godforsaken zero rated crap that everybody hated.
Yeah.
This was the unlimited plan came out in February 2017. And I remember that because
modern, like, use 20 gigs and then get slowed thing.
Yeah, exactly. Like, literally this thing that Google just launched was T-Mobile's first unlimited plan 2 years or 2.5 years ago.
But fast forward to the now where you can get an unlimited plan from T-Mobile, which is Google Fi, for the same price, but you get 50 gigabytes before you get throttled.
Yes.
To me, I don't see the value. I wanted Fi to have some sort of plan that, I can keep my $24 plan and then pay for my data. But if I use a little bit of extra data, it just kicks over to unlimited that month and my bill isn't, you know, super expensive.
Right. So this is what frustrated me is so prior to this, and still, you can still get a quote unquote flexible plan, they call it, where you pay $20 a month and $10 per gigabyte. But they recognized that what people wanted was to overpay for unlimited plans to have the stability of knowing that the bill is the same every time. That's why they came up with this bill protection feature where at 6 gigabytes, it capped your data.
Yeah.
So you would always cap at $80. That's where my brain was on 80. So their unlimited plan is now 70, or you can have the flexible plan where it would always cap at 80 and you had the option to, after 15 gigs of usage, go to throttled or start paying again and keep full speed data. And it was just such a good idea because they just effectively eliminated the need for an unlimited plan, but still gave people this cool flexibility where if they used less data, they used anywhere less than 6 gigs, they were going to, in any month at any time, they saved money. But it just shows that, you know, the industry has not been stupid. They know what sells and they know what people are willing to pay, and people are willing to overpay every single month just to know that their bill is the exact same every single month. And it's frustrating. And this was the point of that article that David wrote, was you just see that Google Fi didn't have any other option. They had to just do what the industry was pushing for, and it just doesn't have a lot of draw anymore outside of just simplified, like a nice app and a simplified experience of changing your plan and signing up and that kind of stuff. Other than that, the pricing is effectively the same. The offering is effectively the same. But like Jerry said, they maybe throttle you earlier or something like that. And it's just kind of frustrating because I could easily see at some point them just doing away with the flexible plan.
Don't do it.
I know. I don't want them to do it either because I love it. Even though I had, like last month, we did a lot of traveling, went to IFA, and my bill was like $90 or something like that. Every once. Other month, it's 45. So
exactly. If you're listening and you're thinking about trying Google Fi, do yourself a favor and try one of these plans that Andrew and I are talking about first. It's dead simple to switch if you don't like it, but you pay $20 plus whatever fees your state charges for the phone and all the voice and texting service. And then data is expensive. It's 10 gigabytes or $10 per gigabyte. But especially if you have a Pixel or any device that can have that Google virtual VPN, leave your Wi-Fi on, go about your normal day. And if you're like me, at the end of the month, you're only using maybe 2.5 gigabytes of data because you've got Wi-Fi everywhere. There's a Starbucks or a Target or a Best Buy or a GameStop. You're on Wi-Fi.
So the frustrating part there is that that's just like the argument has always been there and people just won't take it. And we've seen it even in the prepaid space now. The big deal with prepaid is huge data buckets, and you pre-buy 3, 6, 12 months, and like that's kind of where your value proposition is. All the carriers postpaid are just going to these unlimited plans, and it's just frustrating because Google Fi, like, it doesn't have to be huge. It doesn't have to go after the huge part of the market, but they're just doing what everybody else is doing. So that's just kind of a frustrating thing, even though it is like it's pro consumer. I get it. You have two options now where you used to have one plan option, and they opened it up to any phone. And, you know, so that's nice too. More people are using Fi now than they did before, but it, you know, in typical googly fashion, I kind of expected it to stick with the, you know, what it was doing and not try to go mainstream.
Andrew, you know, all they had to do, half the price of the data.
Oh,
If it was $5 per gigabyte instead of 10, they would have doubled their subscriber base.
Right. But here's the thing. And here's what David's, hypothesis is, or his argument. That they had no choice, right? T-Mobile and Sprint yep. are merging, and they will get approved. It's just a matter of time. And one thing that they had said was eventually wholesale prices will go down. This is what they've promised. This is how they got it through the FCC and wholesale, how they got in, the DOJ to well, say wholesale, yes.
Really quick, is what they the massive amounts of data they sell on the cheap to MVNOs to resell.
Right. So what T-Mobile is saying is that MVNOs like Google Fi have two choices. They could lock in for a particular amount of time at the wholesale rates they currently have, or they can go with the market rate, which may go up in the short term and then go down in the long term as they launch 5G. So it's sort of like Google and all these MVNOs are hedging and figuring out whether they should prepay or lock in for a specific amount of time. And I'm guessing T-Mobile went to them and said, listen, all of our other MVNOs have this sweetheart deal where we're giving you 22 gigs as a, you know, a soft cutoff, and we're throttling after that. But your stipulation is, like all of our customers, your video streams are going to be limited to 480p. And if you're okay with that, we'll give you the right to offer unlimited. And I'm guessing because Sprint's network is considerably smaller than T-Mobile's, Google really didn't have a choice in the matter. So, you know, it's one of the last MVNOs to push back on unlimited. In fact, I think it's one of the only MVNOs that doesn't offer a single unlimited plan. It's unfortunate, but at the same time, this is where the market is going. And if Google wants to increase its user base, they have to do this.
Absolutely. I don't know what their numbers look like, obviously, but I would not be surprised if they've effectively plateaued with their pay per gigabyte plan.
So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's interesting. I love talking carrier stuff. I could do it all day, but I feel like it's very US centric. It's alienating to all of our international listeners. So I apologize. We're done. We're going to go to break, and then we'll come back and talk about the Mate 30 Pro. Be right back. This episode of the Android Central podcast is brought to you by Keeps. So losing your hair sucks. It's true. It happens. But if you've started to lose your hair and you really want to keep the rest of it, Keeps is the service for you. It's the most affordable way to get the only two FDA-approved hair loss products out there. And you can do it all online in under 5 minutes. So here's how it works. You go to Keeps. You sign up, you answer a few questions and snap some photos of your hair, and a licensed physician will then review your info and recommend the right treatment. It could be one or both of those products, and then it's shipped to your house every 3 months. You take it every day, and that's it. You hopefully keep your hair. Now, Keeps is not guaranteed to work, and it won't regrow your hair. There is a lot of evidence to show that these products do stop, or at least slow, hair loss. And as somebody who's lost all of his hair, I could have really used this 10 or 15 years ago. So if you're interested in signing up for Keeps and keeping your hair, go to keeps.com/ACP. That's KEEPS.com/ACP. And get a free month of treatment by going to keeps.com/ACP for a free month. Keeps, hair today, hair tomorrow. All right, so let's talk about the show, shall we?
Which one?
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about the slightly less terrible
okay. thing
later. I don't want to keep swearing because people
well,
get mad.
No, this is one of those times you're allowed to, Daniel.
Okay, so let's talk Mate 30 Pro. This is a phone that had leaked a lot. We knew basically everything about the phones because there are two. There was a splashy launch event yesterday in Munich, Germany. Huawei CEO Richard Yu went on stage and he announced the Mate 30 Pro. One of the nicest, I think, nicest looking phones on the market. I think one of the most impressive phones technologically on the market. Just a huge number of features in there that I respect. I love the P30 Pro. I think it's probably my favorite phone of 2019 so far, aside from the Pixel 3a. It's just, there's so much going for it. And yet the main topic of conversation was not the fact that it has two 40 megapixel cameras on the back, or that you can now do 27 watt wireless charging, or that it has a new Kirin 990 chip with integrated 5G. It's that it's not launching with any Google services. Andrew, this is not a surprise, but we didn't know how Huawei would treat that news once it went public. And we also didn't know what solutions Huawei would offer when that information went public. So walk us through exactly what happened.
And also, not all of the information is extremely clear at this point, because I think even Huawei was kind of holding out until the last moment, hoping that they would be able to go with, you know, their original plan. But basically what's happened is that they are just legally not allowed to work with Google. And so they're not allowed to have a device that ships with any part of Google services. So Google Mobile Services is just not present. That means you don't have Play Services, the Play Store, any of Google apps. I think this was some of the early confusion among people saying, oh, well, I don't care about Google's apps. Like, I already use Microsoft's apps or whatever. I use this, that, and the other thing. You don't get the Play Store at all. You don't get the underpinnings of Play Services that even if you were to sideload apps, you would somehow go get them somewhere else and sideload them. Apps are built with hooks to Play Services. They will install and they won't run because they can't run because they're looking for dependencies that they expect to be built into every phone with the Play Store, but it doesn't have those dependencies. And so even if you sideload apps, they won't run. So Huawei did the best thing that it could, and it said, we're going to start distributing our Huawei mobile services that we currently, you know, curate and sell millions and millions of phones with in China. We're going to regionalize those into all these other regions, and we're going to launch them globally on the Mate 30 series. And at the same time, we're going to pledge to spend at least $1 billion courting developers to come bring their apps over to our Huawei App Gallery, I believe it's called, and distribute those. And it's the same kind of thing. People said, okay, well, developers will be able to just grab their APKs and upload them to App Gallery. Again, no, they have to redevelop their apps in, you know, sometimes small ways, sometimes big ways, to remove all the dependencies that they're looking for in Play Services and plug into Huawei's APIs that they will expect to be on the Mate 30. Long story short, it's going to take a very, very, very long time and a lot of money to get this to work, even a tiny bit.
So Huawei does already make something called the Huawei Mobile Services solution. It's for Huawei phones that are sold in China, and it's for the apps there to do exactly what Google Mobile Services do in the West. It provides things like location services. It provides a notifications backend, so apps don't have to have their own notification server. It provides a game like a centralized cloud gaming store, so you can hook up with your friends and play mobile games. I mean, it does basically what Google Play Services already does, but just for the Chinese market. And until now, Huawei hasn't been forced to develop HMS outside of China, and that is a big ask. So they're spending $1 billion at least to court developers, but apps like Facebook's Instagram, WhatsApp, Uber — Facebook doesn't own Uber, I'm just saying — as well as Uber, Dropbox, all of these apps, they still rely on Google services. It's going to be really hard to hack these apps to work with the Mate 30, and most people are not going to want to do that.
The developers themselves aren't going to want to do it. I'm not saying they won't. Dropbox is a good example. That's nothing to do with Google at all. In fact, they're a competitor to Google because of Google Drive. But they still use Play Services. They use cloud messaging. They use the sync connectors. Those can be recoded to work with Huawei's version. But will Dropbox do it? That's just the big question.
Right. Will Dropbox do it? But also, is there anything in them for, you know, A, they'll have to keep two APKs yep. updated in two separate stores. And we know that even with the Amazon App Store, companies aren't great at keeping their APKs updated. So why would they do it for the Huawei store?
I mean, there's already this big question because this is just a very interesting situation because Huawei already runs all of this stuff just for China, which is an absolutely massive market with whatever 1.2 billion people or something like that, a billion mobile phone customers and hundreds of millions of which are Huawei customers. So they already know how to do this in China, and these apps and services have not already gone there. And that's an already established massive market. It's not like they're coming from nowhere, and they already, like, even given that, they're still in a massive uphill battle, which is kind of crazy.
I saw an interesting take on all this yesterday on Twitter. Above and beyond all of this, let's say the Dropboxes and Uber of the world, they're roaring to go, and they start working on getting it in the Huawei app ecosystem right away. Well, other things that Google do, one is security. Is Huawei going to spend as much money on security to police their store as Google is willing to do? And number two, Huawei services are designed for China. Anything you do, unless Huawei changes it, do you want your phone in Ottawa or San Francisco, San Diego, to be reporting back to Beijing?
And that is a really big question. So another part of Play Services is Google's Play Protect system that is constantly scanning phones for malicious software, even if it didn't come from the Play Store. And so even when you did sideload apps, or you installed another app store, like Huawei is talking about here, potentially doing third-party app stores as well, Play Protect was always looking out, finding remotely killing software on people's phones that was bad. That's not that system is not there either. And it's a little bit of, kind of stepping back 5 years in the Android ecosystem.
Right. And policing the store is important too. We see stories that, 11 million Android phones installed this app before Google removed it from the Play Store. Man, that might have only been 15 minutes. There's 2 billion people using the Play Store. Google scans it continuously and finds apps that either don't meet their requirements in one way or another, or do something that Google deems as dangerous and shuts it down. Yes, it may be up long enough for 10 million of the 2 billion users to have downloaded it, but Google does an excellent job there. Huawei can, but are they willing to?
I mean, that's the funny part, is that Google is often criticized for not, for making Android less secure, quote, than iOS. But the amount of work that it does to police those 2 billion active users is insane. It's, yep. It's significant, and it should not be undersold. Huawei just does not have, as big as Huawei is, it just doesn't have the resources or the experience to do anything close to what Google is doing with Android.
And that's even, like I said, even given their experience in doing it in China, it turns into a whole nother thing when you go internationally. And just like every other company that makes Android phones, a lot of the stuff is provided to them. It's handled by Google, of course, and that's a huge benefit. And this, of course, brings up the old question about how much value or how much control Google has over Android. But this is a perfect example. This is showing you how much Google provides. It's not just its own apps. It's not just the Play Store, which obviously are both massive things, but it's all this other stuff too. And so now the question also is that I've seen, I woke up to a million Twitter notifications this morning, is people saying, well, all you do is you just go here and you sideload Google apps. So, like, Jerry, what's the problem with that?
Well, maybe nothing, but probably impossible. Sideload, you have to flash these. These apps, they're files and folders that are in use where your phone is turned on. They're in a place where you can't just install it. the system itself has to put these files and folders in the correct place while the phone's not running. You have to do it from the bootloader. Unless you've rooted your phone and you're really, really good at the command line, then you can copy some things in one at a time. But for the average user, that's just never going to happen. But Huawei could have built that phone with the it's called GMS Core. It's a set of changes to some of the framework files that have to be in place for these other parts of GMS to work. Huawei could have built their software with those little bits in place. Without Google's help, they could have done that. Then a smart developer can
Hang on a second. I want to interrupt you. Would that be illegal for Huawei to do that, given that they're not allowed to work with Google?
Not if they reverse engineered it themselves and know how to do it. And I'll put air quotes around reverse engineer it, because sure, they know how it works. They've sold plenty of phones with Google services on them. They know exactly what to do and where to do it. You know, as long as they're not using the code from Google, could they do it themselves? Sure. You know, maybe there's a intellectual property argument to be made there, but I'm not even going to go into that. But if they did, a smart developer can write an app that you install, and it can fetch this stuff, and you restart your phone, and it can have it in the right spot, and then you sideload the Play Store, and then everything works. They've done that with plenty of Honor and Huawei phones that are sold in China only and don't have any of these services.
Right. And the thing is that, from what I understand, it's trivially easy to install the Play Store using an existing Huawei or Honor phone sold in China, which don't come with the Play Store preloaded, because those GMS Core files are loaded on the file system somewhere. So you just they're sort of like the building blocks of what makes up the Play services.
Exactly. Yeah, they're those the green base for your Legos that everything else can snap to are already there.
So we don't know whether the Mate 30 ships with those Lego blocks, but we would assume they don't. And there are a couple reasons why we would assume that. First, Richard Yu said it, that it is impossible to install the Play Store, in the sense that right now, in its current fashion, the Mate 30 will not work with the Play Store. We do have evidence from the show floor yesterday that people tried sideloading the Play Store and Google services and apps and got nowhere. So the app would open and then it would just shut off, and that was that.
Because, I mean, Huawei would be so stupid to have put that stuff in. Even if they were going to do it later, it would be so, so dumb for them to walk the line of putting the GMS Core in there.
Right. So the next thing we know is that Huawei actually plans to unlock or allow for the bootloader of the Mate 30 series to be unlocked, which is something that the company shut down in 2018. They previously allowed older phones to be bootloader unlocked, and they shut it down for two reasons. They said that it was onerous on their part to maintain the system, because like all bootloader unlocking services from Motorola to HTC, you basically had to, you know, enter your IMEI, and then they would generate an unlock code that you would then need to go into fastboot and enter. It was complicated. Huawei said, for security reasons, we just don't want you rooting our phones anymore. We don't want this hassle. And then they shut it down. This is now going to come back in some form, because what else are they going to do? If they want to sell this in the West without Google services, they kind of have to let custom ROMs work so that people can sideload Google apps.
But let's be frank and honest here. Even if they do that, they're not going to make enough money selling these phones in the West to bother even trying. We're talking, you know, relatively small handful of people that are going to be able to unlock their phone and then install some sort of bootloader firmware that can flash files manually. Huawei's not going to give you an unlock bootloader and a custom recovery in there. That's never going to happen. They just can't do that. That phone will be compromised instantly, you know, on the security front. And it's not that hard to do, but are either one of you two guys going to sit and write a custom recovery using the instructions from Google so you can flash the Google apps to the Mate 30 Pro. Hell no, you're not.
No, but no. a lot of people who live in XDA will, and they'll
sure,
you know, they'll do it properly. Yes,
we're talking, you know, 5-10 million of people will want to do this, and a good portion of them will buy the phone and actually do it. But is it worth rolling out a release to the entire Western Hemisphere for 5 million users?
I mean, you're being really generous there.
Massive under on 5 million.
Yeah, I'm talking like 500,000. Well, and yes, I am being
super generous on purpose, because even that number, 5 million, if you can only sell 5 million handsets, it's not worth spending the millions and millions of dollars to roll out a Western release.
So we do know that the company plans to sell this in the UK, parts of Europe, and Australia. I have it off. I sort of have an inkling based on sources that I've talked to that Huawei had planned on launching this in Canada and has now shelved the launch or canceled it altogether. It's tough because Canada is the company's proxy to the U.S. It's the way that the company gets its handsets close to the U.S. People can come and import it from Canada. The bands are all the same. So it's not the same as importing the European or Australian version where the bands are all different. So it's unfortunate that's not launching in Canada also because I won't get to try it. And this is a really nice phone otherwise. There's a lot of things going for it aside from the camera, but I think the camera is fantastic. It's a 1/5.7-inch sensor, which is even bigger than the one in the P30 Pro. And there's a whole lot of other improvements to it as well. So Alex Doby has one. He has one of the Chinese units. He'll hopefully be on the show next week to give us his impressions. But by the time you listen to this, we have a hands-on and a video live. So go to Android Central, read the hands-on, watch the video on YouTube, and let us know what you think about the Mate 30 Pro at podcast@androidcentral.com. Because, I'm curious. Would you buy a phone without Google services? It doesn't sound like most people would, but then again, who knows?
No, it's a really exciting phone, though, and it's really unfortunate that we had to spend the last 25 minutes just talking about the Play Store situation, because it's the reality. It's nothing else really. I mean, let's be frank, nothing else matters about the phone. It could be the best phone in the world. It just doesn't matter if you can't use the apps and services that you're accustomed to using. And as I pointed out in my editorial yesterday, it was just that it no single Android phone is any better than another in any way to make you give up access to the Play Store or easy access to the Play Store and the apps and services. And it's also in light of this conversation that we had at the start of the show, where there are three new iPhones that have better access to Google services at a minimum on top of, you know, all the other services than the Mate 30 Pro. It's like, man, that is really putting Huawei in just the toughest possible position, on top of the fact that there's another 10 amazing high-end Android phones that you could choose from that do all sorts of things, and other phones in the $400 to $700 range that do amazing things. It's just the Android market is so good across the board at so many different price points that how can you go through the hurdles? I mean, whether it's Jerry's 5 million people or Daniel's 5,000 people, like, how can you even bother going through that? It's like, just go buy a Galaxy S10 Plus and just turn it on and have it all just work out of the box and be happy with it.
Yeah, but then it only has a camera from 2016, so.
Oh, man. Or just wait and buy a Pixel 4, I don't know.
Yeah, so We didn't talk about it, but the Pixel 4 event is official. It got announced for October 15th, and we'll be there. It's in New York City. It starts at 10 a.m. Eastern, and no, 1 p.m. Eastern, 10 p.m. Pacific, 10 a.m. Pacific. They already have the live stream up on YouTube because they're thirsty. But we also know that there will be a Pixel Book 2, a revamped Google Home Mini, and potentially some other cool stuff. So we'll wait and see until October 15th to see how Google responds to the two big announcements from this week. Your final thoughts on the Mate 30? Can we move on?
this is a bigger problem for Google than it is for Huawei. Once legislators, especially in the EU, investigate this a little bit, it really points the finger that, yes, Android is open. Yes, Google gives it away to OEMs for free and everything. But Google's thumb is on the scales with everything. And unless Google says yes and gives you the nod, you're unable to compete, even if you're Samsung.
The thing is that I disagree with it, and yet I can still see the EU using it as an example of Google's power. That's the crazy thing. It doesn't matter whether it's reality.
I'm not saying that that's a right take, but that's the take they're going to have.
I suppose so. I mean, I think that's a whole other topic that we should probably talk about, especially since the EU is still actively investigating Android and Google's dominant position in the market, and has already forced Google to unbundle Chrome and search from Android phones in the EU and offer alternatives. So that is already in place. If you buy a phone in the EU, you get a choice of what search engine to use and what browser to use. And that's, you know, I think that's great, because probably 95% of people will choose Google search and Chrome. But again, like, the choice is there, so why not? Let's talk quickly about the Galaxy Fold, because it's back and it's worse than ever. I don't really know how to put this, but Google...
It's back and it folds.
But Samsung is being really, really precious about this new phone, even in its, quote, fixed format. They've launched a bunch of YouTube videos on how to care for your Galaxy Fold. You're not supposed to touch it too hard. You're not supposed to close it too hard. You're not supposed to bring it near water or dust. Basically, never leave your house with the Fold.
You're not supposed to give Samsung $2,000 for it, is my take from all of that.
Pretty much. So really, really different strategy from the bravado of the early days, because obviously they learned that didn't work. And then on top of that, Jerry Rig Everything, Zach from Jerry Rig Everything, he releases his teardown video. And I mean, you have to watch this thing. It's like scary how easy it is to mess this phone up, even if it's in its new form. Andrew, is this surprising at all?
No. I should say, I know a lot of people have not touched this. Most people have not touched this. I guarantee that nobody listening to this podcast has touched this phone. But when you have, you realize how far we've come with our regular, you know, phones, what we think of as a boring old smartphone, being this solid metal and glass, mostly sealed. I mean, sealed from water, if not from, you know, everything else. Just single object with no moving parts, to all of a sudden we're going way, way back to the thing that has to fold, and the screen is made of plastic, you know, or is an OLED panel covered in plastic and another piece of plastic. And it has, even with the new design, open hinges and like all of these things that we take for granted now in terms of the durability of smartphones have not been around for that long. 10 years ago, every single phone was just as vulnerable and easy to break as this thing. We've just forgotten about how bad those things were with all these physical components. So it's not surprising at all to me that the thing is just as fragile. It's just the things that were fixed about the Fold are the accidental, even if you take care of it perfectly, it still breaks problems. We still have the inherent folding phone problems. And this was what I talked about when I got to use the new one at IFA in Berlin a couple weeks ago, was I'm looking forward to being able to evaluate the Fold for what it is, not with these just totally random flaws where even if you keep it in a clean room, you still get a speck of dust under there and then the display dies in a week. I hope that they fixed those problems. And so we're still just going to find out that the folding phone is still extremely, extremely fragile.
I mean, it's, yeah, really not surprising. Jerry from Zach Rig Everything, he punctures the plastic screen with his knife. He just taps it with his knife.
He is great at breaking stuff, isn't he?
He's really good at it. Almost as good as you are.
He's like, it's an actual tear down. It's not one of these precise pull apart and maybe reassemble things.
I watch all of their videos, and for most phones, they have to really try to damage them. But and you should too. All the videos where they try to break phones, they are the best videos on YouTube. But they didn't have to even try with the Fold.
So what he does is, I'm trying to find it in the video right now. It's around, I think, 5 minutes or so.
Where he jukes the knife through it?
Yeah. Oh,
that's
here it is.
So
okay,
satisfying.
So he punctures the screen around seven minutes or so. And basically, he taps the screen with his knife on the left side on the edge, and an entire row of pixels dies, as well as any touch response from that part of the screen.
And you can say, well, you shouldn't be poking your phone with a knife. Right, you shouldn't. But what if you have a sharp spot in the setting on your wedding ring?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just saying, like, it's so easy. But what is happening there? Like, what is actually happening to the screen?
He's either going through the plastic protective layer or pushing it down with enough force in a tiny spot that the OLED panel's breaking underneath. The digitizer is breaking underneath it. Those have to be so thin with this design that they just have no durability.
And the big question is, I mean, this reaches back several months when we first used the Fold, and I and Daniel both used the Fold for whatever, a week, and ours didn't break. They didn't have problems, but so many of them did, obviously, that this whole thing came through. But when you see that the revised one still has these same durability concerns, which they always should have been there, they didn't change those parts. How do you actually evaluate the phone when, you know, it was the case last time, our phones were fine, but we knew inherently that they were so fragile that they were not going to be fine. It was just a matter of time. It was a when, not if, it's going to fail for some basic reason, even if you don't take a razor blade to it. How do you evaluate that now?
Every review of the Fold, all it needs to be is Zach's video underneath a headline. That is the review of the phone. This phone is going to break.
It's what do you do? You know, can you prevent it? Is it worth the mental overhead of being worried about your phone breaking?
You know, it's the cool factor's there. And if somebody wants to buy it for the cool factor and baby
it's
along,
undeniably cool.
Yeah. If you want to buy it and baby it just so you can have it, yeah, that's cool. But know that you've got to baby the heck out of this thing.
And that's what makes it makes it so hard to evaluate how. Because the idea is still so neat, and the software is actually, I felt like the software was improved and it made a lot more sense, and I ran into fewer hiccups on the new one. All of these things, like Samsung is clearly still making improvements, but the state of technology cannot overcome these problems. And my goodness, Huawei should not even consider bringing out the Mate X. Right now, I mean, on top of all their other issues, Huawei's got plenty of problems to deal with. They could definitely put the Mate X on a shelf in general, but this thing has the plastic screen on the inside, and the Mate X has it on the outside. You want to talk about that thing having screens get damaged inadvertently, even when you baby the thing. The Mate X is just, the thing is just going to fall apart in your hands. There's no way.
You know, this is the one and only time maybe LG did it right.
Shut
I never
your
thought
mouth.
I'd say those words.
Yep,
shut your
exactly.
mouth,
exactly.
Jerry.
Thank you very much, Jerry.
That is wrong. That is a bad take, and that's why I'm ending the show. No, I'm joking. We talked about this a lot last week, actually. I totally dislike the way that LG is doing it. I think it's lazy and totally it's practical, I guess. I called it utilitarian. But I agree. Like, I'd rather have a Fold that I have to baby because it's truly innovative than a hacked LG G8 that you have to put inside another case. It just, to me, that is not a solution to this problem.
I really hope that there's a Fold 2 and it's better, and then there's a Fold 3 and it's better, and then the Fold 4 is the one we all should be buying. That's the way they, you know, iterated the Note, turned it from some weird device that only a crazy smartphone nerd would really want into something that was awesome. And they can do it with the Fold. They're Samsung. They love to throw billions of dollars at things until it works. And we benefit.
So I guess on that note, we'll end because Andrew's got a, he's got to run, literally, I think. You're running every day, aren't you?
Yeah, and you woke me up early to do this podcast, and so, you know.
Are you running to the ocean to throw a Galaxy Fold in?
I know. I don't have a Fold to hand at the moment. And if I did, that is actually another interesting thing. We'll close on this. The Fold is still gigantic and heavy and thick. I don't think that I could realistically run with it the same way I run with my Note 10.
You run with your Note 10?
Yeah, in an arm strap.
Oh, like I thought maybe the baby 10 or the big 10?
10 plus, man.
Oh my God.
You've got one of those little wagons like you put an infant in when you're jogging.
Yeah, exactly. You just need a stroller for your Note 10
it
plus.
It is not that bad, but it is definitely the upper limit of what I would want to have on there, and the Fold is like two Note 10s.
That's hilarious. That's true, actually. It is two Note 10s, basically. All right, well, Let us know what you think about all of these things at Podcast at Android Central. We love, love, love hearing from you. By the way, just a little PSA. Jigglypuff. Jiggle Physics is going to be moving to its own feed starting on Monday. Thank you, everybody, for your feedback, both positive and negative. We really appreciate it. If you do like the show, though, please follow it to its new feed. Take a listen. Russell and Co. really would appreciate your support as we start building up this channel from scratch. Tell your friends if you want to hear more gaming podcasts from the Mobile Nations Network. Jiggle Physics will live in a new place starting next week. All right, that's it for the show. Andrew, Jerry, you're the best. And all of you listening are also the best. Thanks so much, and we will talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody.
Adios.